Stevenson was confident that his position as clan head in Indiana would protect him from prosecution, and was astonished when he was convicted of kidnap, rape, and second-degree murder, and sentenced to life in prison. In revenge, he released documents that exposed corruption at the highest levels in Indiana. The mayor of Indianapolis and the head of the Republican Party in the state were both jailed for taking payoffs. The governor should have been, but escaped on a technicality. The entire Indianapolis City Council was dismissed and fined, and a prominent judge was impeached. The whole affair was so squalid and disgusting that Klan membership everywhere collapsed, and the Klan retreated into the shadows of American life. It was never a national force again. Remarkably, the Ku Klux Klan was not the most dangerous outpost of bigotry in America in the period. That distinction belonged, extraordinary though it is to state, to a coalition of academics and scientists. Since early in the century, a large number of prominent and learned Americans had been preoccupied, often to the point of obsessiveness, with the belief that the country was filling up with dangerously inferior people and that something urgent must be done about it. Dr. William Robinson, a leading New York physician, spoke for a vociferous minority when he declared that people of an inferior nature have no right, in the first instance, to be born, but having been born, they have no right to propagate their kind. W. Duncan McKim, also a physician and author of Heredity and Human Progress, proposed that the surest, the simplest, the kindest, and most humane means for preventing reproduction among those whom we deem unworthy of the high privilege is a gentle, painless death. The problem, as most saw it, was twofold. America was producing far too many defectives through careless and unrestricted breeding, while at the same time introducing almost limitless volumes of additional inferiority through unrestricted immigration from backward nations. Nearly everyone had an especially dreaded race. The writer Madison Grant disdained Jews because of their dwarf stature, peculiar mentality, and ruthless concentration on self-interest, as he put it. Frank J. Loesch, a member of a presidential commission on crime reform, thought the problem was Jews and Italians together, with the Jews furnishing the brains and the Italians the brawn. Charles B. Davenport, one of the most eminent scientists of his day, was more expansively dubious and listed Poles, Irish, Italians, Serbians, Greeks, and Hebrews as less intelligent and reliable, more susceptible to depravity and crimes of violence than people of sound Anglo-Saxon or Teutonic stock. These were not people, in Davenport's view, who could be lifted out of their bad habits, but were immutably condemned by their genes to be troublesome, destructive, and dull. They were creating an America that was darker in pigmentation, smaller in stature, and more given to crimes of larceny, kidnapping, assault, murder, rape, and sex immorality. Madison Grant called it race suicide. All these views were bundled together into the smart new science of eugenics, which may be simply defined as the scientific cultivation of superior beings. In most of the world, eugenics was an innocuous goal, a well-intentioned wish to produce healthier, stronger, smarter people. But in America, eugenics took on a harsher cast. It led to the sinister belief that procreation should somehow be regulated and directed. As an official of the American Eugenics Society observed, Americans take more care over the breeding of cattle and horses than of their own children. Eugenics was used to justify the introduction of restrictive covenants on where people could live, enforced deportations, the suspension of civil liberties, and the involuntary sterilization of tens of thousands of innocent people. It resulted in the severe curtailment of immigration and its virtual elimination from certain parts of the world. It even led eventually, but more or less directly, to the downfall of Charles Lindbergh, the pilot who once could do no wrong. The Bible of negative eugenics was the fearsome and popular Passing of the Great Race by Madison Grant, a New York lawyer by training, though he never practiced, a naturalist by practice but without training, which was first published in 1916. Grant took it as read that the only really good group of humans was what he called the Nordic race, by which he meant essentially all Northern Europeans except the Irish. Europe divided into three tiers of being, Nordic, Alpine, and Mediterranean, which grew progressively degenerate as one moved south. One obvious problem with Grant's theory was that he had to explain how such wretched people had managed to produce the Athens of Plato and Socrates, the Roman Empire, the Renaissance, and all the other marvels of classical antiquity. Grant's explanation was that in ancient Greece and Rome, the ruling class was composed of Nordic Achaeans, who weren't really Mediterranean at all, but were Northern Europeans who had drifted south. All the great Renaissance artists, Grant maintained, were of Nordic type, largely of Gothic and Lombard blood, he said. All others, the real Italians, were dull, stunted, and shifty, and were genetically condemned to remain forever so. Grant believed that any degenerate genes introduced into the general population would not be diluted and made safe, but would permanently taint the whole. The cross between any of the three European races and a Jew is a Jew, Grant grimly explained. Although none of this was compatible with even the small amounts of genetics that were understood at the time, it appears that Grant was saying exactly what a lot of people wanted to hear. His book was praised by the American Historical Review, Yale Review, and Annals of the American Academy of Political and Social Science. Henry Fairfield Osborne, head of the Natural History Museum in New York and the country's leading anthropologist, wrote the introduction. Among others supporting Grant's views, in whole or in part, were the Yale economist Irving Fisher, the Harvard neuropathologist E.E. Southard, A. Lawrence Lowell of Harvard, the man whose committee condemned Sacco and Vanzetti to death, the birth control activist Margaret Sanger, and Herbert Hoover, who had a lifelong antipathy to people with brown skin. In 1909, in a report for his employers, Hoover declared that black and Asian laborers should be avoided because they suffered from a low mental order and a pathological lack of coordination and inability to take initiative. Stressing his own first-hand experience, Hoover concluded that one white man equals from 2 to 3 of the colored races, even in the simplest forms of mine work, such as shoveling or tramming. If Hoover modified these views in later years, he gave no evidence of it. In 1921, he was patron of a eugenics conference hosted by the American Museum of Natural History in New York, and inspired by the passing of the Great Race. For a time, the principles of negative eugenics, as they became known in America, were practically inescapable. At the Sesquicentennial Exhibition in Philadelphia in 1926, the American Eugenics Society had a stand with a mechanical counter showing that a person of inferior nature was born somewhere in the United States every 48 seconds, while high-grade persons came along only once every 7.5 minutes. The relative rates at which the counters revolved showed all too dramatically how swiftly the nation was being overwhelmed with inferiority. It was one of the most popular displays at the exhibition. The spiritual headquarters for the eugenics movement in America was the Eugenics Record Office, opened in 1909 in Cold Spring Harbor on Long Island's North Shore, and largely funded by the sort of wealthy people who wanted more innately superior beings, like themselves, and fewer of any other kind. The property abutted the estate of the Tiffany family, of jewelry renown. The first director was Charles Davenport, a Harvard-trained biologist. Davenport believed eugenic explanations could be found for every aspect of the human condition, obesity, criminality, propensity to lie or cheat, even love of the sea. Under Davenport, the Eugenics Record Office also made several studies of the deleterious effects of racial interbreeding. As Davenport explained, one often finds in mulattoes ambition and drive combined with low intelligence, so that the hybrid is unhappy, dissatisfied with his fate, and rebellious. A hybridized people are a badly put together people, and a dissatisfied, restless, ineffective people. Davenport argued not just for the sterilization of the inferior and faulty, but for their castration in order to remove desire as well as reproductive ability, just to be on the safe side. Davenport, however, was the soul of enlightened compassion compared with his young protege, Harry H. Laughlin, who may have been the most lamentable person to achieve scientific respectability in America in the 20th century. Born in 1880 in Oskaloosa, Iowa, Laughlin trained at the North Missouri State Normal School and worked as a teacher and school administrator after college, but developed an interest in breeding and enrolled at Princeton to study biology. In 1910, he met Davenport, who was so taken with Laughlin's zeal and devotion to eugenic purification that he made him superintendent of the Eugenics Record Office. Laughlin's credo was simple: to purify the breeding stock of the race at all costs. As Edwin Black notes in War Against the Weak, Laughlin's plan of attack was threefold: sterilization, mass incarceration, and sweeping immigration restrictions. In furtherance of these goals, Laughlin created the imposingly named, ferociously vengeful, Committee to Study and to Report on the Best Practical Means of Cutting Off the Defective Germplasm in the American Population, which had the self-assigned task of eradicating reproductive inferiority from America once and for all. Laughlin's committee was chaired by David Starr Jordan, president of Stanford, and included scientists and academics from many of America's best universities, Harvard, Princeton, Yale, and the University of Chicago, among others. The committee also included a brilliant but eccentric French surgeon, Alexis Carrel, from the Rockefeller Institute in New York. Carrel's extreme views on eugenics, which were in some respects little short of mad, would contribute significantly, even dangerously, to Charles Lindbergh's opinions, but mercifully, that was still some way off. Laughlin, meanwhile, was tireless in his efforts to root out and limit human inferiority wherever it arose. The House Committee on Immigration and Naturalization appointed him its expert advisor and assigned him the task of determining the comparative degeneracy of various ethnic groups. To persuade the members of how urgently reforms were needed, Laughlin filled the committee chamber with photographs of drooling mental defectives, all identified as recent immigrants, beneath a banner reading, "Carriers of the Germplasm of the Future American Population." Congress could not resist the authority of the committee or Laughlin's horrifying propaganda, and it quickly pushed through the 1921 Dillingham Immigration Restriction Act, followed by the 1924 National Origins Act. Together, these ended America's open-door immigration policy. By 1927, more people were being deported from Ellis Island than were coming in through it. That more or less settled the problem of imported inferiority, but left the issue of home-produced backwardness, of which there was a separate abundance. Laughlin and his supporters turned their attention to that challenge with, if anything, even more enthusiasm. They conducted tests on large blocks of people and repeatedly produced unnerving results. They reported that up to 80% of all prisoners and half of servicemen were feeble-minded. New York alone was calculated to contain as many as 200,000 mentally subnormal people. Altogether, it was believed, about one-third of the American population was dangerously backward. The solution, in Laughlin's view, was sterilization on a massive scale. He believed in sterilizing not merely the insane and mentally deficient, but also orphans, tramps, paupers, the hard of hearing, and the blind, the most worthless one-tenth of our present population, as he put it, with a certain conspicuous absence of compassion. In 1927, the question of how freely the state could exercise the power of sterilization came to a head in a legal case known as Buck v. Bell. The case focused on a 17-year-old girl in Virginia named Carrie Buck, who was deemed to be of low intelligence and had only recently given birth to an illegitimate child, in consequence of which she was now confined in the Virginia Colony for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded at Lynchburg. Her mother was already an inmate there. In 1924, Carrie Buck was selected for sterilization by the colony's superintendent, Dr. John H. Bell, hence Buck versus Bell. The heart of the case was that not only was Carrie Buck mentally incompetent, but so were her mother and daughter, three straight generations of defectives. The family, it was argued, was clearly incapable of producing other than mental defectives and ought to be sterilized for its own good and the good of society. The evidence against the family was hardly overwhelming. Laughlin, the state's chief witness, pronounced against the Bucks without ever having met or examined any of them. He declared that Carrie Buck came from a shiftless, ignorant, and worthless class of Southerner, and should be rendered incapable of producing more of her kind on grounds of class alone. The charge of simple-mindedness against Vivian, the daughter, was made purely on the word of a social worker, who examined the child once and thought there was something not quite normal about her. But she freely added, "I should say that perhaps my knowledge of the mother may prejudice me in that regard." The child was just 6 months old at the time. No tests then existed for determining the mental capabilities of such a young person. In fact, Vivian was later shown to have normal, possibly even above-average, intelligence. She died of an intestinal disorder, aged just 8, but her performance at school to that point was entirely capable, and once she even made the honor roll. Carrie Buck herself was clearly not retarded in any meaningful sense, if at all. She read newspapers every day and enjoyed the new craze for crossword puzzles. An academic who later interviewed Buck described her as not a sophisticated woman, but neither mentally ill nor retarded. Nonetheless, when given the new Stanford version of the Binet-Simon test, which eventually became the modern IQ test, and it is interesting to reflect that the IQ test was invented not to determine how smart people are, but how stupid, Carrie Buck was determined to have a mental age of 9, while her mother didn't quite make it to 8. Officially, they both fell into the classification of moron. The case came before the U.S. Supreme Court in the spring of 1927. The court ruled, by a vote of 8-1, that Buck should be sterilized. The majority opinion was written by 86-year-old Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., a man of such long life that he had fought as an infantryman in the Civil War. Holmes summarized the situation concisely. "Carrie Buck is a feeble-minded white woman. She is the daughter of a feeble-minded mother in the same institution, and the mother of an illegitimate feeble-minded child." He agreed with Laughlin that sterilization was necessary in society to prevent our being swamped with incompetence. Then he gave his solution. "It is better for the world if instead of waiting to execute degenerate offspring for crime or to let them starve for their imbecility, society can prevent those who are manifestly unfit from continuing their kind. The principle that sustains compulsory vaccination is broad enough to cover cutting the fallopian tubes." Then came the ringing conclusion that has been quoted ever since. 3 generations of imbeciles are enough. Only one justice, Pierce Butler, dissented from the majority view, and he did not offer a written opinion to explain his dissent. Holmes was supported by all the other justices, who included Chief Justice and former U.S. President William Howard Taft and the liberal Louis D. Brandeis. Thanks to this ruling, states now had the right to perform surgery on healthy citizens against their will, a liberty never before extended in any advanced country. Yet the case attracted almost no attention. The New York Times gave it a small mention on page 19. The news leader of Richmond, Virginia, where the matter was a local story, didn't report it at all. Slowly, sentiment began to turn against negative eugenics. Many serious geneticists, like Thomas Hunt Morgan of Columbia University, would have nothing to do with it, and in the summer of 1927, Harvard quietly declined a gift to endow the university with a chair in the subject. Harry H. Laughlin, however, seemed unstoppable. He became increasingly, and in retrospect very oddly, hostile to epileptics, insisting that they must either be sterilized or by some means confined during their reproductive years. The oddity in this is that it is now known that Laughlin was secretly an epileptic himself. He sometimes had seizures at Cold Spring Harbor, which his colleagues overlooked or covered up, even as they were condemning sufferers elsewhere. In the 1930s, Laughlin sowed the seeds of his downfall as he began to establish warm relationships with Germany's newly emergent Nazis, some of whom came to Cold Spring Harbor to study American methods and findings. In 1936, the University of Heidelberg awarded Laughlin an honorary degree for his commitment to race purification. The following year, Laughlin and Cold Spring Harbor became U.S. distributors of a Nazi documentary called The Hereditarily Diseased, which argued that it was foolishly sentimental to keep retarded people alive. This was more than many people could countenance. At a convention of the American Jewish Congress in New York, the keynote speaker, Bernard S. Deutsch, attacked Laughlin in the bitterest terms. "Dr. Laughlin's purification of race theory is as dangerous and as spurious as the purified Aryan race theories advanced by the Nazis, to which it bears suspicious resemblance," Deutsch said. The Carnegie Institution, the Eugenics Record Office's chief source of funding, appointed Herbert Spencer Jennings, a respected geneticist from Johns Hopkins University, to review Laughlin's work. Spencer found that Laughlin had falsified data, manipulated findings to support racist conclusions, and generally perpetrated scientific fraud for over a quarter of a century. Laughlin was forced to step down from the Eugenics Record Office, and it was effectively closed in 1938. Laughlin retired to Missouri, but a huge amount of damage had been done. Altogether, at least 60,000 people were sterilized because of Laughlin's efforts. At the peak of the movement in the 1930s, some 30 states had sterilization laws, though only Virginia and California made wide use of them. It is perhaps worth noting that sterilization laws remain on the books in 20 states today. In late September 1927, Carrie Buck, her legal options exhausted, was scheduled for sterilization, and the procedure was carried out the following month. Her sister was sterilized as well, but without knowing what was happening. She was told she was being treated for appendicitis. Chapter 27. In the spring of 1927, just before the Snyder-Gray trial consumed the world's attention, an arresting story appeared as the second lead on page one of the New York Times. As an indication of its significance, the Times gave it seven stacks of headlines. It said, "Far-off speakers seen as well as heard here in a test of television. Like a photo come to life. Hoover's face plainly imaged as he speaks in Washington. The first time in history. Pictures are flashed by wire and radio synchronizing with speaker's voice. Commercial use in doubt. But AT&T head sees a new step in conquest of nature after years of research." The accompanying report described how reporters and officials at AT&T's Bell Telephone Labs on Bethune Street in Manhattan had watched in astonishment as a live image of Commerce Secretary Herbert Hoover in Washington materialized before them on a glass screen about the size of a modern post-it note. More than 200 miles of space intervening between the speaker and his audience was annihilated, marveled the anonymous reporter. Listeners could even hear Hoover's speech. "Human genius has now destroyed the impediment of distance," the Commerce Secretary intoned with gravity and pomp. As each syllable was heard, the motion of the speaker's lips and his changes of expression were flashed on the screen in the demonstration room, explained the Times man. "It was as if a photograph had suddenly come to life and begun to talk, smile, nod its head, and look this way and that." Mr. Hoover was then succeeded by a comedian named A. Dolan, who first told some stories in an Irish brogue, then quickly changed into blackface and returned with a new line of quips in Negro dialect. This, too, was deemed visually excellent. It appears, however, that the reporter may have been carried away by the emotion of the moment, because the AT&T equipment was not capable of projecting really clear images. Realizing this, AT&T abandoned all attempts to conquer television soon afterwards and left the field open to others, of whom there were many. As a theoretical notion, television had been around for some time. As far back as 1880, a French engineer named Maurice Leblanc saw that images could be sent a bit at a time because the eye retains an image for about a tenth of a second, and thus can be fooled into seeing intermittent images as whole ones. It's why we see movies as a continuous show rather than as thousands of individual frames. That considerably simplified the challenge of transmission. 4 years later, a Russian named Paul Nipkov invented a system using a spinning disk to scan images onto a sensor through holes placed at calculated intervals around the disk. It was a tricky proposition, and Nipkov failed to make it work. But his disk became the standard on which nearly all subsequent attempts at creating television were based. The term, television, itself was coined by Konstantin Perskyi for the Paris exhibition in 1900, though many other names were used for various devices in the early days: iconoscope, radio visor, electric eye, even electric telescope. By the 1920s, four parties were thought to be close to breakthrough: teams at Bell Laboratories and General Electric in the United States, and the individuals Charles Francis Jenkins in Baltimore and John Logie Baird in Britain. For all the effort and anticipation, no one knew quite what television would be good for. The general assumption was that the applications would mostly be practical. Scientific American, in an article entitled "Motion Pictures by Radio," foresaw television as a crime prevention device. A criminal suspect might appear simultaneously in 1,000 police headquarters for identification, it supposed. AT&T saw it not as an entertainment medium, but as a way of allowing people on telephones to see each other. Only Charles Francis Jenkins saw clearly what TV could offer. The new machine will come to the fireside, with photoplays, the opera, and a direct vision of world activities, he predicted. Though forgotten now, he doesn't even have an entry in the American Dictionary of National Biography, Jenkins was an accomplished inventor. He owned over 400 patents, several of them for successful products, some of which we use yet. If you have ever had a drink from a conical paper cup, you have used a Jenkins product. But one invention that was never going to work was his radio visor, as he called it. Even if he got it working, which he did not, it could only ever transmit 48 lines of image, not enough to show objects as anything other than shadowy blurs. It would be like trying to identify objects through frosted glass. But this was the deliriously upbeat 1920s, and although Jenkins did not have a product to sell, or anything more than a vague and ultimately unrealizable hope that his system could be developed into something commercially appealing one day, he formed a corporation which was soon valued at more than $10 million. Much the same sort of inflated optimism attended the efforts of John Logie Baird, a Scotsman based in London. From an attic flat in Soho, Baird created a stream of mostly useless inventions, including inflatable shoes and a safety razor made of glass so it wouldn't rust. His private life was equally unorthodox, in that he and another man shared the affections of a woman who had once been Baird's girlfriend, was now the second man's wife, and who found it impossible to choose between the two. In true British fashion, the arrangement to share was agreed between all three over a cup of tea. As an inventor, Baird was inspired and indefatigable, but always painfully short of funds. Most of his working models were assembled from salvaged oddments and other scraps. His first Nipkov disc was the lid of a lady's hat box. His lenses were made from bicycle headlights. Wondering if he might get a better resolution of his images if he shone them through a real human eye, he called at the Charing Cross Ophthalmic Hospital and asked if they had any eyes they could spare. A doctor, thinking him a qualified anatomist, gave him one. Baird took the eye home on the bus, but discovered that the optic nerve was useless without a blood supply. And anyway, when he clamped the eyeball into his contraption, he made such a gruesome mess of it that it made him ill, and he put it all in the trash can. Still, he persevered, and in 1925, in his lab, Baird managed to transmit the world's first recognizable image of a human face. Baird was an accomplished publicist. One of his stunts was to place a working TV in a window of Selfridge's department store, drawing crowds great enough to stop traffic. And that brought a rush of financing. By 1927, Baird was at the head of a company that had nearly 200 employees. He was not a good company man and hated having to answer to a board of directors. Developing a particular dislike for Sir Edward Manville, the pompous chairman imposed on him by his principal investors, Baird had a lab built with an intentionally narrow entrance. The portly Manville, on his first visit, got stuck and had to be pushed through from behind. As Baird recalled proudly, he lost several buttons from his waistcoat and dropped his cigar and tramped on it in the process, and never visited the lab again. The inescapable shortcoming of a Nipkow system, as Baird found to his unending frustration, was that it required a pair of large, noisily whirring disks, one to send and one to receive a signal, and could produce, at best, only a small image. A 4-inch square picture would require spinning disks 6 feet across, not something that many people would want in their living rooms. The disks could be dangerous, too, as a visiting scientist to Baird's lab painfully discovered when he leaned too close and his long white beard was yanked into the workings. The reality that Baird and all the others involved with mechanical television could never overcome was that spinning disks simply could not provide the clarity of image necessary to make television a commercial proposition. In practical terms, it was impossible to produce more than about 60 lines of imagery, and the viewing screen could never be larger than about the size of a drinks coaster. Nevertheless, Baird persevered, and by the summer of 1927 had about as good a working model as his system could provide. On September 8th, slightly less than 5 months after the Bell Labs presentation with Herbert Hoover, the New York Times reported another exciting demonstration of television, this time from England. As reporters looked on, Baird used his mechanical system to send a live image of himself more than 200 miles from Leeds to London. His image was clear, but it was also frustratingly small, at just 2.5 inches by 3. And when magnified to a larger size through a special lens, it lost all clarity. In fact, unknown to Baird, the New York Times, and everyone else in the world at large, television had actually had its real birth one day earlier in far-off California, when a young man with the resplendent name of Philo T. Farnsworth, the greatest inventor of whom most people have never heard, used cathode ray tubes and an electron beam to produce an image that genuinely had the promise to make television an enchanting reality. Philo Farnsworth, the forgotten father of television, was born in 1906 in a log cabin in Utah. His parents, pious Mormons, moved the family to a farm in Idaho not long afterwards, and it was there, in the idyllic surroundings of the Snake River Valley, that young Philo spent a happy childhood. He was uncommonly bright and devoured everything he could find on science and technology. In the summer of 1921, while ploughing his father's field, the 15-year-old Philo had a scientific epiphany. He had been reading Einstein's theory on electrons and the photoelectric effect, and now it occurred to him that beams of electrons could be scanned onto a screen in a back-and-forth pattern, exactly as he was ploughing his father's field, one line at a time in alternating directions. Within months, he had devised a workable plan for transmitting images electronically. He made a sketch of it, which he showed to his high school chemistry teacher, Justin Tolman. Luckily for Farnsworth, Tolman was so impressed that he kept the drawing. It would later confirm Farnsworth's priority for the invention. Lacking financing, Farnsworth left the idea undeveloped and instead finished high school, married his sweetheart, and enrolled at Brigham Young University in Salt Lake City. One day, Farnsworth fell into a chance conversation with two young businessmen from San Francisco who were so impressed with his ideas that they offered to invest $6,000, which is to say their entire joint savings, in the project, and to help him secure a bank loan. With this, Farnsworth set up a small lab on Green Street in San Francisco. He was still just 20 years old, too young, as he discovered, to sign the contract on the bank loan. Farnsworth filed his first patents for television in January 1927. Building a working television system was an almost ridiculous challenge. Parts couldn't be bought off the shelf. Most of them didn't exist, except in Farnsworth's fertile brain. So nearly every glowing valve and gently thrumming tube had to be designed and built from scratch. Farnsworth and a small team he assembled worked feverishly, and by early September were ready to transmit the first image ever using electronic apparatus. The image was only a simple horizontal line, and Farnsworth only sent it as far as the next room, so it didn't have the romance and awe of Baird's or AT&T's imagery. But it did have one thing the rival inventions didn't have, a future. At the heart of Farnsworth's system was something called an image dissector camera, which allowed him to paint, as it were, pictures across a screen by scanning them in electronically one line at a time, and to do it so quickly that the eye is fooled into thinking it is seeing a series of continuous images. Even in its earliest versions, Farnsworth's system had 150 lines, giving it a crispness that no mechanical system could ever achieve. Although the wider world knew nothing of Farnsworth's invention, people who understood electronics soon learned of it and came to marvel at his work. One visitor was the physicist Ernest Lawrence, who was overjoyed to behold a part of Farnsworth's device called the multipactor, which concentrated electron beams and fired them in bursts, multiplying their intensity. Inspired, Lawrence returned to Berkeley and produced the world's first particle accelerator. Eventually, Farnsworth had 165 patents, including for all the important elements of modern television, from scanning and focusing images to projecting live pictures across great distances. But the one thing he didn't have was any way of making the whole enterprise commercial. Enter David Sarnoff. Sarnoff's world was radio. From a technical point of view, he didn't know the first thing about television. He didn't actually know that much about radio. But he had two qualities that Farnsworth signally lacked: commercial acumen and vision. He was the one person in the world who could transform television from an interesting laboratory novelty into something that everyone would want to have within 10 feet of his sofa. Sarnoff was born in a poor village in rural Russia, in what is now Belarus, but moved with his family to the Lower East Side of New York in 1900, when he was 9. He could not have been more of a yokel. Before his trip to America, he had never seen a paved road. Now he was in the most colossally dynamic city on Earth. Sarnoff learned English, quit school at 14, and went out to make his mark on the world. He landed a job as an office boy at American Marconi, the telegraph company, and there became an adept wireless operator. Throughout his life, he claimed to have been the first person to receive and relay onwards the news of the Titanic sinking from an office in Wanamaker's department store. According to Sarnoff's own version of events, and Sarnoff's versions of events only ever loosely intersected with what actually happened, he stayed at his post for 72 hours and more or less single-handedly coordinated rescue efforts. In 1919, American Marconi was bundled into a new company called Radio Corporation of America, or RCA. Sarnoff, young, ambitious, instinctively opportunistic, quickly became master of the new medium. He made radio popular and profitable, two things that were by no means assured in 1920. Radio, at the time, was an exciting novelty, but a radio set was also a costly investment, and people weren't at all sure that it was worth the outlay, particularly if the only available programming was provided by a local bank or insurance broker or poultry farm. Companies that made radios didn't care what people listened to or whether they listened at all once the radios were bought. Sarnoff, remarkably, seems to have been alone in seeing that if there wasn't anything worth listening to, they wouldn't buy radios. He realized that to succeed, radio needed to be organized, professional, and above all, entertaining. As a demonstration of radio's potential, he arranged to broadcast the Dempsey-Carpentier prize fight on July 2, 1921. Sarnoff reasoned that if people realized that they could listen to exciting events live as they happened, they would flock to radio. To that end, he had loudspeakers erected at various locations where people could listen to the fight for free. 10,000 listeners packed into Times Square, and other demonstrations were laid on elsewhere. In the event, a technical fault meant there was no live broadcast from ringside. Instead, the details of the fight were relayed by ticker tape to a Manhattan studio, where an announcer recreated the fight from sketchy details and a great deal of imagination. That is what the crowds heard. It didn't matter. They thought they were hearing the fight live. The idea of being able to know what was happening as it happened seemed to many an almost impossible miracle. Radio now took off. At the time of the Dempsey-Carpentier fight, one American home in 500 had a radio. Within 5 years, the proportion was 1 in 20. By the end of the decade, saturation would be nearly total. Never before had a consumer product gained universal acceptance so quickly. To improve broadcast standards and secure RCA's dominance of the industry, Sarnoff persuaded his masters to join with Westinghouse and General Electric to form a radio network, the National Broadcasting Company. NBC's successful broadcasts of big events, not least Lindbergh's arrival in Washington in June 1927, were so impressive that they inspired the creation of a second network, the Columbia Broadcasting System, which began broadcasting now in September 1927. Its principal investor was the Columbia Phonograph Corporation, which wanted to sell more phonograph albums. Network broadcasting proved to be extremely expensive. Radio was unique among entertainment media in that it didn't charge for content. Once someone bought a radio, he could listen to all the programs he wanted in perpetuity for free. On top of that, the programming was dismayingly ephemeral. Movies could be shown again, plays could be performed over and over, but a radio play or concert or variety show was broadcast once and then was gone forever. Even if it could be recorded, nobody wanted to hear the same programs night after night, so radio had constantly to generate new material at often quite staggering costs. NBC executives were horrified to discover that their two regular opera programs were costing the network $6,000 a week. It was so hard to make a profit that some insiders wondered whether radio had a commercial future. The obvious solution, selling advertising, was curiously slow to take hold. In the beginning, programs, if they had any commercial content at all, just mentioned the name of a sponsor, without making any kind of overt sales pitch. Commercial radio also had to contend with the stout opposition of Herbert Hoover, who, as Secretary of Commerce, controlled the airwaves. Hoover believed that radio should apply itself to noble, sober purposes. If a speech by the president is to be used as the meat in a sandwich of two patent medicine advertisements, there will be no radio left, he declared, and threatened to take away licenses from the worst abusers. Luckily, however, by the summer of 1927, Hoover was so busy with other matters, the Mississippi flood at first, then getting himself elected president, that he lost the will or ability to follow through. Sarnoff was only too happy to take advantage of this. He found, as he suspected, that listeners didn't mind advertisements at all. By its second year on air, NBC was selling over $10 million worth of ads a year. By the early 1930s, radio advertising was worth over $40 million a year, in a market that was greatly shrunken by the Great Depression. Newspaper advertising fell by a third, and magazine ads by closer to a half as radio advertising took off. Nearly 250 daily newspapers folded in the decade after the birth of network radio. Listening to the radio became the thing that every household did, and David Sarnoff could legitimately take the credit for almost all of that. By 1929, just before the stock market crash, RCA stock was 10,000% higher than it had been just 5 years before, and David Sarnoff was the darling of the radio industry. And in the midst of all this, he discovered television. In 1929, Sarnoff attended a conference of radio engineers in Rochester, New York, and there saw a presentation by a clever inventor named Vladimir Zworykin. Like his compatriot Igor Sikorsky, the aircraft designer, Zworykin had grown up rich in Russia, but had fled to America following the country's revolution. Although Zworykin spoke almost no English on arrival, he landed a job with Westinghouse in Pittsburgh, and so impressed the directors that he was soon given his own lab. Zworykin foresaw the possibility of electronic television in exactly the way that Philo Farnsworth did. Television was what he talked about in Rochester, and it transfixed Sarnoff. Sarnoff saw at once the future of television as an even greater potential medium for entertainment and wealth creation for RCA, and now threw himself behind its development with an almost alarming enthusiasm. Zworykin told Sarnoff that he could deliver a working system in 2 years for a cost of $100,000. Sarnoff hired him and provided him with everything he could need. As things turned out, it would cost RCA more than $50 million to get a working system together, an incredible gamble for an unproven technology. Worse, Sarnoff discovered that the most vital patents, and much of the attendant insight, resided with a young man with the improbable name of Philo Farnsworth in San Francisco. For Farnsworth, things were not going so well. Broadcasting a clear image of a line was one thing, developing it into a fully-fledged entertainment system was quite another. Even a fairly basic setup would require millions of dollars of investment, which Farnsworth clearly didn't have. Learning of his progress, Zworykin paid him a visit. Farnsworth, thinking RCA wished to license his patents, happily showed Zworykin everything, including how to make an image dissector, the apparatus at the very heart of his system. Thanks to this help, RCA now quickly developed an image dissector of its own. Sarnoff airily informed Farnsworth that RCA didn't actually want or need his patents. This was a lie. But that it was generously prepared to offer him $100,000 for everything. Patents, diagrams, working models, and all the contents of his lab. Farnsworth dismissed the offer as the insult that it was. Increasingly desperate for funds, Farnsworth sold out to the Philadelphia Storage Battery Company, better known as Philco, and moved east. It was not a happy relationship. Farnsworth hated being a salaried employee. When his infant son died, Farnsworth requested time off to take the boy back to Utah to bury him in the family plot. Philco refused to give him leave, and the two parted ways soon after. Philco, meanwhile, became convinced that RCA was trying to bribe or blackmail its employees into giving away trade secrets. It filed a suit charging RCA operatives with plying Philco employees with intoxicating liquors at hotels, restaurants, and nightclubs. The case was settled out of court. All this made Farnsworth increasingly paranoid and stressed. From the confidently beaming youth of a year or two before, he became a gaunt and driven-looking figure. Even his hair looked angry. He argued with his original investors and flatly refused to collaborate with any outsiders. Eventually, he ended up with a lawsuit against RCA for patent infringement. Sarnoff couldn't bear to come second at anything and never hesitated to crush those who challenged him. When Edwin H. Armstrong, an electrical engineer, invented FM radio, which provided clearer, stronger signals than AM did, Sarnoff did all in his power to have it suppressed by getting the Federal Communications Commission to restrict available bandwidth for it. Armstrong sued and found the wrath of RCA coming down upon him. RCA's lawyers tied him up in court for years. The battle cost Armstrong his health and every penny he owned. In 1954, despondent and broke, he committed suicide. Now RCA waged much the same sort of battle against Farnsworth. It maintained that Farnsworth could not have conceived of electronic television in 1922, on the grounds that a 15-year-old schoolboy could hardly have come up with an idea that had eluded the most brilliant minds of science and technology for years. Luckily for Farnsworth, his old chemistry teacher, Justin Tolman, was able to produce his original sketch in court. That, and the fact that Farnsworth possessed the relevant patents, left the court in no doubt. In 1935, it ruled that Farnsworth was the undisputed inventor of television, a stunning victory for the lone inventor. RCA essentially ignored the ruling. At the 1939 New York World's Fair, it demonstrated a working television that was entirely dependent on Farnsworth patents, for which it had neither made payment nor secured permission. After years of further wrangling, RCA finally agreed to pay Farnsworth $1 million and a royalty on every television sold. However, Farnsworth's most valuable patents ran out in the late 1940s, just as TV was about to take off, so he never got anything like the full measure of wealth to which he was rightly entitled. In 1950, Sarnoff secured a promise from the Radio and Television Manufacturers Association of America that it would refer to him henceforth as the father of television, and to Vladimir Zworykin as the inventor of television. Farnsworth was effectively expunged from the record. Farnsworth retired to Maine and became a desperate alcoholic. He died in March 1971, drunk, depressed, and forgotten. He was 64 years old. The New York Times, in its obituary, referred to him not as the inventor of television, but as a pioneer in the design of television. Sarnoff died later that same year at the venerable age of 80. After television, Vladimir Zworykin helped to invent the electron microscope. He survived Sarnoff and Farnsworth by 11 years, dying in 1982, the day before his 93rd birthday. In an interview in 1974, he claimed never to watch television because it was so mindless, and said that his greatest contribution to television technology was the invention of the off switch. In fact, the off switch was invented by Philo Farnsworth and was part of his earliest patent. Chapter 28. Most of us, given a pad of paper, a pencil, and a few minutes to think, could come up with a reasonably respectable list of writers who were at work in the 1920s. F. Scott Fitzgerald, Ernest Hemingway, William Faulkner, James Joyce, Virginia Woolf, T.S. Eliot, Gertrude Stein, Dorothy Parker, Ezra Pound, and so on. It is unlikely, however, that many of us would think to include the name of Harold Bell Wright. Yet Wright was more popular than any of the people on the list just mentioned, and may well have had greater lifetime sales than all of them put together. In 1925, when the first printing of his novel, A Son of His Father, came off the presses in Chicago, it filled 27 railroad boxcars. His 1911 book, The Winning of Barbara Worth, was so beloved that fans named a hotel, a road, and a school after it. Wright's books were sentimental and predictable. They invariably concerned a person who had been buffeted by life's travails, but then found happiness and success through hard work and Christian fellowship. But people couldn't get enough of them. Much the same could be said of a great many other writers whose names have long since slipped into obscurity. Cosmo Hamilton, Arthur Summers Roach, Coningsby Dawson, T.S. Stribling, Hervey Allen, Stark Young, Herman Kaiserling, Warwick Deeping, Thyrus Samter Winslow, Knut Hamsun, Julia Peterkin, Jean Stratton Porter, Zona Gale, and Mazo de la Roche, all enjoyed greater sales, and often greater fame, than any of the better-remembered authors already cited. None, however, not even Harold Bell Wright at full emotive throttle, could begin to compare with the success of two other American authors whose books sold and sold for decades. They were Zane Grey and Edgar Rice Burroughs, and they were almost certainly the two most popular authors on the planet in the 20th century. They had a good deal in common. Both were from the Midwest. Both came comparatively late to professional writing, Gray at 30, Burroughs at 35, and even later to success. And both were, by almost any measure, pretty terrible writers. The wonder is not that they are no longer widely read, but that they ever were. Of Gray, the critic Burton Rasko wrote, "It is difficult to imagine any writer having less merit in either style or substance than Gray, and still maintaining an audience at all." Burroughs was largely spared such insults because, as a pulp writer, He wasn't deemed worthy of even scornful notice. But the world devoured their output. Nobody knows how many books they sold. Estimates range, rather wildly, from 25 million apiece up to 60 million or so, if translations, posthumous publications, and book-length magazine publications are counted in. Whatever the actual total, for both it was unquestionably a gratifyingly large number. Gray, in an interestingly secretive way, was much the more interesting of the two. Newspaper and magazine profiles in his lifetime portrayed him as a pleasant and unassuming dentist from Ohio who wrote adventure stories in his spare time, hit pay dirt in 1912 with Riders of the Purple Sage, then cranked out a succession of highly popular books, mostly westerns, over a period of nearly 30 years. He invented, or at the very least cornered the market in, many of the conventions of the genre. The black-hearted villain, the bullied rancher and his chaste, pretty daughter, the strong, silent cowboy, whose heart belongs to no female save his warm-nosed mare, as one writer once nicely put it. But Gray had a great secret. In private, he was spectacularly libidinous. An ardent outdoorsman, he often went on long trips into the wilderness with attractive, high-spirited young women, his wife's two young cousins, friends of the family, and slept with them all. Sometimes he took as many as four at a time away with him. Occasionally, he brought them home with him afterwards. As his biographer Thomas H. Pauley reports, there exists an enormous, totally unknown cache of photographs taken by Gray of nude women and himself performing various sexual activities, including intercourse. These photographs are accompanied by 10 small journals written in Gray's secret code that contain graphic descriptions of his sexual adventures. In between these invigorating breaks, Gray lived quietly with his wife, a woman of stoic temperament, in Lackawanna, Pennsylvania, and later Altadena, California, and wrote two or sometimes three books a year. He produced some 95 books altogether, and left so many manuscripts when he died, suddenly of a heart attack in 1939, that Harper and Brothers was still publishing new Zane Gray books 14 years after he died. At his peak, he earned $500,000 a year. In 1927, he made just under $325,000. For purposes of comparison, F. Scott Fitzgerald, in his best year, earned $37,599. Edgar Rice Burroughs had a tamer life than Gray, but then, after all, who didn't? But wrote racier stuff. 3 years younger than Gray, Burroughs was born in 1875 into a well-off family in Chicago. But he was something of a black sheep and struggled to find a role for himself in life. He went west as a young man and tried storekeeping, ranching, panning for gold, and working as a railroad policeman, all without success, before he discovered he had a knack for writing stories. In 1912, at the age of 35, he produced his first hit, Tarzan of the Apes. Burroughs was no hack. He used pulp fiction plots, but wrote with a certain panache, as if he didn't quite understand the genre. Here are the opening lines to Tarzan of the Apes. I had this story from one who had no business to tell it to me, or to any other. I may credit the seductive influence of an old vintage upon the narrator for the beginning of it, and my own skeptical incredulity for the balance of the strange tale. It is not perhaps Tolstoy, but it is certainly far removed from the usual simply worded straight-into-the-action openings of most cheap fiction of the day. In a career that lasted almost 40 years, Burroughs produced some 80 books, including 26 Tarzan novels, a great deal of science fiction, and a few westerns. All his efforts were characterized by exhilarating action, lightly clad females, and an unwavering attachment to eugenic ideals. Tarzan himself could have been the poster boy for the eugenics movement. Tarzan, as many readers will surely know already, is the story of an aristocratic English infant who is left orphaned in the African jungle and is brought up by apes. Fortunately, because he is white and Anglo-Saxon, he is innately brave, strong, decisive, and kind, instinctively ethical, and clever enough to solve any problem. He even teaches himself to read, quite a feat considering that he speaks no human language and doesn't know what a book is when he first sees one. Thank goodness for racial superiority. The creation or maintenance of superior beings is something that preoccupied Burroughs throughout his career. Nearly all his outer space books are concerned with the breeding of master races on Mars or Venus. Footnote: breeding advanced societies on nearby planets wasn't in itself a preposterous notion in 1927. The March issue of Scientific American, no less, contained an article solemnly speculating on whether Mars contained a civilization superior to our own. It also had an article suggesting that humans might be evolving into a race of one-eyed cyclopeans. Other respectable publications posed similar questions about Venus, where it was supposed that the inhabitants lived in some kind of tropical paradise beneath thick Venusian clouds. In Lost on Venus, he writes admiringly of a society in which no defective infant was allowed to live, and citizens who were physically, morally, or mentally defective were rendered incapable of bringing their like into the world. Back on Earth, writing as himself in an article in the Los Angeles Examiner, he insisted that the world would be a better place if all moral imbeciles were systematically eliminated. He even titled one of his books Bridge and the Oskaloosa Kid. Oskaloosa was the birthplace of Harry H. Laughlin, the leading eugenicist. As time went on, Burroughs became increasingly slapdash. He recycled plots and was often arrestingly careless with his prose. His lone novel of 1927, The War Chief, begins, "Naked but for a G-string, rough sandals, a bit of hide, and a buffalo headdress, a savage warrior leaped and danced to the beating of drums." Four paragraphs later we get, "Naked but for a G-string, rough sandals, a bit of hide, and a buffalo headdress, a savage warrior moved silently among the boles of great trees." Occasionally he just slipped into drivel. Here is a Martian warrior named Jeddak whispering sweet nothings to Thuvia, maid of Mars, in a book of that title in 1920. "Ah, Thuvia of Petarth, you are cold even before the fiery blasts of my consuming love. No harder than your heart, nor colder is the hard, cold ursite of this thrice-happy bench which supports your divine and fadeless form." Such passages could run on for some time. It hardly seemed to matter. People were still devotedly buying his stuff when he died in California of a heart attack in March 1950, aged 74. Among serious writers of fiction, only Sinclair Lewis enjoyed robust sales in the summer of 1927. Elmer Gantry was far and away the best-selling fiction work of the year. A satire on evangelist preachers, it was roundly condemned across the nation, especially by evangelist preachers. The fundamentalist preacher Billy Sunday, apprised of its content, called on God to strike Lewis dead, which doesn't seem terribly Christian of him. The Reverend C.S. Sparks of the Congregational Church of Sauk Center, Minnesota, Lewis's own hometown, bitterly contrasted Lewis with the saintly Charles Lindbergh, saying that Lewis possessed a mind that is dead, dead to goodness and purity and righteousness, while Lindbergh was clean in mind and soul. Elmer Gantry was banned in several cities. In Boston, selling it was made an indictable offense, as opposed to just a misdemeanor, as an indication of how severely disagreeable it was. But of course, such prohibitions merely made the book seem more juicily desirable to those who could get it. The novel sold 100,000 copies on its first day of sale, and was cruising towards 250,000 by the end of summer, numbers that not even Gray and Burroughs could count on. Elmer Gantry was the fifth in a string of critical and commercial successes for Lewis that made him the most admired writer of his day. The others were Main Street, 1920, Babbitt, 1922, Aerosmith, 1925, and Man Trap, 1926. In 1930, he would be the first American awarded a Nobel Prize in Literature. Not everyone was a fan. Ernest Hemingway, in a letter to his editor, said, "If I wrote as sloppily and shittily as that freckled prick, I could write 5,000 words a day, year in and year out." Though Lewis had no sense of it just yet, 1927 would mark the apex of his career trajectory. His later novels would fall out of fashion, and he would end up an alcoholic, so racked with delirium tremens that he would be confined in a straitjacket. Hemingway produced no novel in 1927. He was mostly preoccupied with personal affairs. He divorced one wife and wed another in Paris in early summer, just about the time Lindbergh was flying in. But he did come out with a volume of short stories, Men Without Women. Dorothy Parker, in The New Yorker, called it a truly magnificent work. I don't know where a greater collection of stories can be found. But the book didn't stir the same public excitement as Hemingway's debut novel of the previous year, The Sun Also Rises. Also well-received, but not runaway commercial successes, were The Bridge of San Luis Rey, by a new writer named Thornton Wilder, and Mosquitoes, by another newcomer, William Faulkner. F. Scott Fitzgerald, the other American literary giant of the age, to us, if not to his contemporaries, produced no book in 1927. Instead, he made his first trip to Hollywood, lured by a commission to write the screenplay for a movie called Lipstick. The fee was $3,500 up front, with a further $12,000 on acceptance. But in the event, his script was deemed inadequate and turned down, so the bulk of the fee was never paid. Fitzgerald also had a screen test, but he didn't do well at that either. In the end, the trip to California cost him far more than he earned. Fitzgerald was fading fast in 1927. The Great Gatsby, published 2 years earlier, had been a failure. Unsold stacks of the book sat in the warehouse of Charles Scribner's Sons, his publisher, and would still be there when Fitzgerald died, broke and all but forgotten, in 1940. Not until the 1950s would the world rediscover him. The publishing industry was in a state of interesting flux in 1927, and that was largely owing to a long-standing prejudice. Traditionally, publishing was closed to Jews, except at menial and dead-end levels. All the old firms, Harper and Brothers, Scribner's, Doubleday, Houghton Mifflin, Putnam's, were solidly white and largely Protestant, and their output tended to be carefully conservative. That began to change in 1915 when a young Jewish man named Alfred A. Knopf, the son of an advertising executive, started the imprint that still bears his name. Knopf brought America the works of Sigmund Freud, Franz Kafka, Jean-Paul Sartre, Albert Camus, André Gide, D.H. Lawrence, E.M. Forster, Thomas Mann, and many others. The preponderance of foreign authors was explained simply by the fact that many American literary agents would not deal with a Jewish publisher. All this cast the conservatism of the old-line WASP publishers into sharp relief. Charles Scribner's Sons, a family firm founded in 1846, boasted for years that it never published a word that would make a maiden blush, but now found itself struggling to keep up with changing mores. In early 1927, when Maxwell Perkins, its most celebrated editor, was working on Hemingway's aforementioned volume of short stories, he felt he had to alert Charles Scribner II, the firm's head, that it contained certain words that might shock him. Perkins was so old school that he could not bring himself to utter the actual words, but wrote them down. One word he couldn't even write down. It was never recorded what the words were, or whether any or all of them made it into the finished book. Interestingly, although Scribner's was squeamish about publishing profanities, it had no hesitation in 1927 in publishing one of the most virulently racist books of the decade, Reforging America, by the amateur eugenicist Lothrop Stoddard. Mr. Stoddard's previous book with Scribner, The Rising Tide of Color Against White World Supremacy, hints a little more clearly at where he stood on matters. In Reforging America, Stoddard argued that America should create a biracial society, by which he meant not one in which people mingled harmoniously, but rather the very opposite, one in which whites and non-whites were kept separate from cradle to grave, so as not to risk cross-contamination to the detriment of either. The book was favorably reviewed in several places. While Knopf was carving out a lucrative niche for itself among foreign authors, another new Jewish firm was finding great success by discovering, or in some cases rediscovering, American writers. The firm was Boney and Livright, named for brothers Albert and Charles Boney and for Horace Livright, and for a short while it was perhaps the most interesting and dynamic publishing house in America. The Boney brothers had until recently run the Washington Square Bookshop, a leftist hangout on MacDougall Street, and Livright was a bond salesman. Although the three founders didn't have a lot of expertise in publishing, the firm quickly made a name for itself. The men squabbled endlessly, and by the early 1920s, both Boneys had departed, leaving Livright as sole head. In the 3 years 1925 to 1927, he produced what was perhaps the most dazzling parade of quality books ever to emerge from a single publishing house in a concentrated period. They included An American Tragedy by Theodore Dreiser, Dark Laughter by Sherwood Anderson, In Our Time by Ernest Hemingway, who then eloped to Scribner's, Soldier's Pay by William Faulkner, Enough Rope by Dorothy Parker, Crystal Cup by Gertrude Atherton, My Life by Isadora Duncan, Education and the Good Life by Bertrand Russell, Napoleon by Emil Ludwig, The Tebows by Roger Martin Dugard, forgotten now, but he was soon to win a Nobel Prize, The Golden Day by Lewis Mumford, three plays by Eugene O'Neill, volumes of poems by T.S. Eliot, Ezra Pound, E.E. Cummings, Edgar Lee Masters, and Robinson Jeffers, and a work of cheery froth by Hollywood screenwriter Anita Loose called Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, purporting to be the diary of a dizzy gold digger named Lorelei Lee. Gentlemen Prefer Blondes wasn't great literature, but it sold and sold and sold. James Joyce was said to be enchanted by it. Livright was a great publisher, but a terrible businessman. He gave advances that were too indulgent, employed far more people than he needed to, and paid them more than he should have. Because of his bad business decisions, Boney and Livright made profits of just $1,203 in 1927 and was in serious danger of going out of business. Livright exacerbated matters considerably by investing heavily, and generally unsuccessfully, in the stock market and on Broadway. In 1927, he found temporary salvation from an unlikely source. He brought over from London a play that had been a big success there, Dracula. For the American production, he selected a little-known Hungarian actor named Bela Lugosi. Although Lugosi had been in America for 6 years, he still spoke little English and learned his lines phonetically without really understanding what they meant, which gave him interesting diction. Lugosi had started his career playing romantic leads, but in 1926 he played a villain in a small but memorably named movie called The Devil in the Cheese. On the strength of that, it seems, he landed the role of Dracula. On September 19th, it opened at the Schubert Theater in New Haven, Connecticut. After a successful 2-week tryout, it had its formal premiere at the Fulton Theater in New York on October 5th, just before Lugosi's 45th birthday. In what may have been the best idea he ever had, Livright hit on the gimmick of having a nurse stand by at each performance to help those who fainted, to emphasize just how terrifying an experience Dracula was. The ploy worked brilliantly. Dracula was a huge hit and ran for a year in New York, then toured for 2 years more, making Livright a lot of money when he most needed it. It was also the making of Bela Lugosi, for Lugosi essentially did nothing else for the rest of his career but play Dracula. He starred in the 1931 movie and a great number of sequels. He also changed wives often. He was married 5 times and became addicted to narcotics. But professionally, he did almost nothing else for almost 30 years. Such was his devotion to the role that when he died in 1956, he was buried dressed as Count Dracula. For Horace Livright, Dracula proved a reprieve, not a solution. The firm went under in 1933, but by then its good work was done. Thanks almost entirely to Knopf and Livright, American publishing was vastly more cosmopolitan and daring by the late 1920s than it had been just a dozen or so years before. After an uninspiring spring and summer, Broadway was stirring promisingly at last. Two plays of lasting note were in rehearsals in September. One was Funny Face, with music and lyrics by George and Ira Gershwin. Starring Fred and Adele Astaire and Betty Compton, mistress of Mayor Jimmy Walker, it would be a great hit and would run for 250 performances. Among its songs were My One and Only and It's Wonderful. Jimmied into it in a burst of topical exuberance was a role featuring a Lindbergh-esque aviator. The 1957 film version was completely different and cut the aviator. It also preserved just four of the original songs. Far more influential was a complex musical about life on a Mississippi riverboat. Called Showboat, it would change musical theater forever. As one theater historian has put it, the history of the American musical theater, quite simply, is divided into two eras, everything before Showboat and everything after Showboat. Showboat was based on a novel from the previous year by Edna Ferber, who had just recently, and quite late in life, become extremely successful as a writer. 42 years old in the summer of 1927, she was from Appleton, Wisconsin, the daughter of a Jewish shopkeeper. She was small and round, never married or had a partner, and carried a sharp tongue. Once, the camp author Michael Arlen, seeing Ferber in a double-breasted jacket, said, "Why, Edna, you look almost like a man." To which Ferber replied, "Why, Michael, so do you." Thanks to her wit, she was welcomed to the Algonquin Roundtable, the informal luncheon club of wits who gathered every weekday in the Algonquin Hotel, and professionally embraced by George S. Kaufman, the most successful comedic playwright of the day. They collaborated extremely successfully on a string of comedies. However gifted Ferber was with comedy, her skills as a novelist have not weathered well. The novel Showboat is a kind of hilarious anthology of bad writing, in the candid words of John Lahr. In evidence of her propensity to write like a teenager on diet pills, he cites this passage. "The Mississippi itself was a tawny tiger, roused, furious, bloodthirsty, lashing out with its great tail, tearing with its cruel claws, and burying its fangs deep in the shore to swallow at a gulp land, houses, trees, cattle, humans even." But it was a different age, and many found the book enchanting. Among its greatest fans was the composer Jerome Kern. He all but begged Ferber to let him make it into a musical. Ferber was doubtful that it could be done, but allowed him to try. The result was what one theater historian has called perhaps the most successful and influential Broadway musical play ever written.